It was going to be the year of the Unix desktop. On March 27, 1984, the telephone giant AT&T announced that they will make computers and compete with IBM. At the centerpiece of AT&T's market strategy was the legendary operating system Unix. Powerful and quote-unquote open, AT&T saw Unix as key to beating Big Blue. A year later, they released their first Unix PC. Guess what happened next? In today's video, that time AT&T attempted to use Unix to become a computer company. But first, I want to remind you of the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first with selected references attached. Really appreciate it, thank you, and on with the show. In January 1982, AT&T signed an agreement with the US Justice Department to break itself up. There were various reasons for them to agree to this. The company was facing intensifying competition thanks to the rise of wireless technologies like microwave. The courts were slowly prying open their closed telephone equipment ecosystem, and attitudes towards their monopoly in Congress and the White House were becoming increasingly unfriendly. They foresaw years of trials and appeals ahead. In the end, AT&T management decided that this attention was forcing them to compete with one hand tied behind their back, so it would be best to willingly split up and move forward with a cleaner slate, regulation-wise. So, AT&T divested the 22 Bell operating companies it once owned. These companies maintained the Bell System's regional phone networks. Now they were off on their own, in the form of seven companies called the Baby Bells. The two-year breakup was messy and chaotic, an organizational disaster both inside and out. Customers and employees alike were confused. Nevertheless, it was completed in January 1984, thrusting the former monopoly into a brand new competitive landscape. During the monopoly days, the Bell operating companies handled local service, and AT&T connected distant calls between cities. After the breakup, AT&T retained that network, along with its R&D arm, Bell Labs, and its manufacturing arm, Western Electric. Long-distance lines revenues remained a significant revenue driver. In 1983, 60% of AT&T's $30 billion of revenue came from that business. However, it was clear that this long-distance business wouldn't last forever. Old long-distance service foes like MCI and Sprint were coming hard for it. MCI with their wireless microwave network, and Sprint with their fiber-optic lines laid near railway track. AT&T was also bracing for competition from its own former subsidiaries, the Baby Bells. From the very start, these smaller companies started to distribute their own products and offer services that competed with AT&T's. This means lost revenue. But as they say, when the gods close a door, they open a small, very difficult to squeeze through window, commercial computing. But that means locking horns with a computer giant, IBM. In the early 1980s, it seemed increasingly clear that AT&T and IBM were on a collision course, as the lines between computer and telecommunications started to blur. An example of this was the increasing digitization of the PBX, or Private Branch Exchange System. The PBX is a private telephone network that can route telephone calls internally and externally. So if a company's employee wanted to call a colleague, a PBX lets them do that with just extension numbers and without tapping external lines. I know it sounds weird, but that is how things worked before Slack existed. AT&T once dominated this space back when everything was analog devices. But in the 1970s, smaller competitors like Rohm and Northern Telecom, better known as Nortel, sad story that one, introduced new digital PBXs. AT&T did not respond quickly enough, causing their market share to fall to below 25%. And that matters because PBXs were seen as the starting point for a broad range of other office automation services and tools. In 1982, IBM bought a 15% stake in Rohm, one of the aforementioned digital PBX makers. They eventually acquired the whole company, giving them a foothold into that business. There were also rumors of IBM potentially partnering with some of the Baby Bells. a concerning scenario for AT&T because the Baby Bells' regional networks can help drive local office adoption. Another looming threat was IBM's increasing investment in satellite transmission systems. AT&T's biggest asset was its nationwide copper telephone network of lines and switches. In the early 1980s, IBM started investing millions of dollars into satellite communications through a joint venture called Satellite Business Systems, or SBS. SBS wanted to put up a fleet of satellites to provide businesses with communication services. AT&T's fear was that satellite would let IBM make an end run around its billion-dollar copper network, turning it into a stranded asset. All these developments meant that, in AT&T's eyes, they had no real choice but to go into computers. In this battle of the giants, IBM's position in computers and data processing seemed unassailable. Having solidly captured the market in the mid-1960s with their breakthrough System 360 computers, IBM still held 65% of the mainframe industry over 20 years later. A few years ago, in the late 1970s, there was the public perception that IBM had gotten too slow and bureaucratic to compete in new spaces like microcomputers. But the amazing success of the IBM PC dispelled that, and in 1982, IBM seemed more invincible than ever before. The guys at AT&T knew they faced a formidable opponent, and that people doubted that they can handle the competition after 30-plus years in a monopoly environment. But they argued that people should not discount their chances right off the bat. With the PC ascendant, retailers and partners were starting to be concerned that the microcomputer ecosystem would be consolidated and controlled by one company, IBM. AT&T wanted to make it clear to those concerned that they would be a reliable alternative. And they had technical chops too. Through Bell Labs, they created many of the core technologies behind modern computers, like the iconic transistor. And for decades, they produced their own computers and terminals for managing telephone records. Through Western Electric, AT&T even made their own semiconductors. As it became clear that they were going to make commercial computers, AT&T had Bell Labs design and Western Electric fab a new state-of-the-art CPU, the 32-bit WE32000, or Bell Mac 32. And seemingly most importantly, AT&T owned a very special asset. AT&T had Unix. Unix will forever stand as a monumental landmark in computing history. It was first developed inside Bell Labs by Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie as a simpler alternative to an earlier failed time-sharing computer project called Multics. Unix bundled several helpful features into a single system, like, for example, a standardized hierarchical file system that abstracted away storage complexity by turning everything into a file. A command line interface that allowed the user to easily interact with the system, if you know the right commands, of course. And a set of small, single-purpose programs like ls and grep, the outputs of which can be chained together using something called pipes to accomplish more complex tasks. Then in 1973, Thompson and Ritchie rewrote the Unix kernel in a new higher-level programming language called C. C made the OS portable, able to run on cheap, modest hardware. You can take all the software you have and drop it into another Unix computer. Perhaps more important than Unix's technical features was its unique economic and cultural situation. In 1956, AT&T struck a consent agreement with the U.S. government that let them keep their manufacturing arm, Western Electric. As part of the decree, AT&T agreed to stick to its core business of phone service. AT&T and the Bell system used Unix extensively inside the company. However, because of the consent decree, AT&T could not sell this pretty functional tool to traditional commercial customers, like businesses. So, Western Electric licensed Unix to universities for basically nothing, about $250. But they offered nothing other than the code, requests for new features, bug reports, nah. So grad students and universities like UC Berkeley modified the code, adding popular features like networking. Some of these remixes, like BSD Unix, became quite popular among certain circles. Starting in 1982, AT&T started cleaning up and consolidating the many Unix variants it then had under its control. so excluding Berkeley's BSD or Microsoft's Xenix, so that they can create a single canonical Unix for commercial clients. In 1982, they released Unix System 3, which combined a mix of internal Unix flavors like Writer's Workbench and Programmer's Workbench. Still intended for internal use, it was, nevertheless, an important preparatory step for commercialization. Then, in January 1983, at Uniforum, they announced Unix System 5, the first commercial version of Unix, with improved file utilities and standardized libraries. AT&T started licensing System 5 to computer makers with the goal of making it an industry standard. Though, it should be important to note that System 5 still lacks certain popular tools that non-AT&T Unix variants had, like for example the shell, which is a command line interface for inputting programs and communicating with the OS. Many users seem to prefer BSD's Berkeley shell over System 5's shell. AT&T's strategy was to be the integrated all-in-one provider of everything touching data from networks to computers to phones to software. Their market entrance strategy involved 30 products across a range of verticals. For businesses, AT&T would sell its first digital PBX, the Dimension System 85. From there, they will expand into office automation by introducing a series of tools integrated with the PBX. For residential, AT&T will attempt to put a bunch of equipment into households. A small personal computer or home terminal device bundled along with their telephone, possibly connected to other computers in the area. The idea is that at some point, people at home or work will want to communicate with others using their computer, and the computer they use the most will eventually dictate the communication services they get. Unix would be the sinew tying all these machines together. Its portability and non-proprietary open nature would let Unix programs communicate with each other and work in parallel with ease. John Knapp, publisher of the Unix World magazine, extolled the possibilities in a 1984 editorial. In it, he positioned IBM and Apple as proliferating proprietary non-compatible standards, standards that lead consumers down a road of wasteful plan obsolescence. AT&T with Unix, on the other hand, offered a different path. Quote, AT&T and others have discovered in the Unix system the great equalizer. By offering a relatively hardware-independent software environment, the good guys are loosening the shackles of forced loyalty. To execute on its new mission, AT&T did an unusual number of outside partnerships. In late 1983, AT&T announced that they had paid $260 million for a 25% stake in Olivetti, the Italian computer maker. Olivetti also agreed to make and supply AT&T with a personal computer to sell into the United States. A month later, AT&T announced that it signed a second deal with an American computer maker called Convergent Technologies. Convergent was a small OEM computer maker founded by former Intel and Xerox PARC employees, producing hardware for other companies like Burroughs and NCR to sell under their own names. Considering we're talking about AT&T, it feels weird to see all these partnerships. Almost like as if, after so many years of being restricted in who they can work with, they went overboard in the other direction. Anyway, in March 1984, AT&T made the announcement everyone was waiting for, that they were taking the giant IBM head-on, and that they were committed. James Olson, AT&T's vice chairman, said, "We intend to play in the market and play in it well." Outside observers pointed out two major questions about AT&T's computer strategy. First, AT&T was at a substantial sales disadvantage against IBM. They didn't start with nothing. AT&T had 900 directly owned phone stores, 6,000 third-party outlets, and its own sales force. But AT&T had not seriously competed in a competitive market for a generation, and IBM's sales and marketing savvy was world famous. There will have to be a transition. Dave Scott, VP of Systems Development at a company called Logisticon, said about AT&T, "If you look at AT&T's marketing policy for Unix, you'll see that it is not enlightened about how to sell to original equipment manufacturers and value-added retailers. AT&T's marketing stance contrasts sharply with that of IBM, DEC, and HP. These manufacturers understand how to structure OEM pricing, that they need to be flexible in their licensing policies, and that different customers desire different levels of technical support. Second, Unix was strong in educational and science applications, but lacked a presence in useful applications for small businesses. Jack Campbell, president of the Unix workstation maker Fortune Systems, said, "You look at an IBM machine with its communications packages, office automation software, and accounting programs, and compare it to what AT&T is offering. Nothing." AT&T knew this, of course, and it seemed promising to outsiders that they reached out to third parties to try and shore up this weakness. Another major deal struck in early 1984, alongside the ones with Olivetti and Convergent, was with the software company Digital Research Inc. to produce a System 5 library. Digital Research Inc. is most well known as being founded by Gary Kildall, creator of the CPM operating system that dominated the computer world before the ascension of DOS. In June 1984, at the popular Comdex trade show held in the Los Angeles Convention Center, AT&T announced the first computers. AT&T entered the show with all the resources you would expect from one of the world's largest companies. Their exhibit was massive. Someone mentioned they had seen, quote, entire shows conducted in smaller areas than AT&T's exhibit, end quote. They rented out the whole 31st floor of the Westin Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles to bring together potential customers and an army of AT&T salespeople. At the show, they presented the 3B series of mini-computers for business accounting and office management. It included a single-user desktop 3B2, the super mini-computers 3B5 and 3B20S, and the high-performance super-duper mini-computer 3B20D. They all ran AT&T's self-made WE32000 CPU, 256 kilobit memory, and ranged in price from $10,000 for the low-end 3B2 to over $100,000 for the 3B20S and $500,000 for the 3B20D. Reviewers liked the computer's obvious power. The WE32000 chip was a beast, but they noted the Unix System 5's complexity and lack of user-friendliness compared to the Apple Macintosh OS, Lisa OS, or even MS-DOS. For example, Unix has 400 commands. Ordinary users don't want to learn 400 commands to use their computer. It seems weird to kick off with a bunch of computers that regular people can't buy. But Jack Scanlon, president of AT&T's computer arm, AT&T Information Systems, said, "We know what we're doing in the computer business, and I'm not at all worried about us being able to take the next step." The 3B mini computers were nice, but people wanted to see AT&T battle IBM in the popular microcomputer sector. But here, they puzzled people with their next computer, the Model 6300, the outcome of its tie-up with Olivetti. Reviewers were disappointed to discover that the 6300 was just another IBM PC running DOS. Released in late June 1984, it had a slightly faster Intel 8086 CPU, and at $2,745 to $4,920, was priced slightly lower than IBM stuff. But that was it. This was weird. After all, didn't AT&T make a big show of how they wanted to make Unix an industry standard? That Unix would really tie all those computers together, just like that rug in the Big Lebowski? Charles Marshall, chairman of AT&T Information Systems, explained their thinking. "We had to recognize that in the marketplace today, there are thousands of MS-DOS machines. Thousands of programs have been run under that system, and our customers have a big investment in that software. For us to ignore that fact and to go off on our own would not make sense." The 6300 can connect to the 3B Unix mini computers via local area network or LAN software. So the thinking was that users can run their existing DOS applications while also familiarizing themselves with Unix through a communications terminal. AT&T managers also argued that marketing and selling the 6300 will help get people to see This 99-year-old company is doing computers and not just telephones. Not an unreasonable justification, but did they really have to put out such a mid-computer? It's interesting to note that the same week AT&T announced the Model 6300, Compaq also announced their Desk Pro, their first IBM-compatible desktop. The Desk Pro remained compatible with DOS applications, but added new features, like additional slots for peripherals, thusly differentiating itself from IBM's products. Benjamin Rosen, Compaq's chairman, told the New York Times, "There is this uninformed feeling in the industry that you can't conform with the IBM standard and differentiate your product at the same time. I think we are showing that this is not the case." International Data Corporation estimated that in 1984, AT&T captured just 2.7% of the medium-sized computer market. DEC led with 28.9% and IBM 22.7%. InfoCorp estimated that AT&T sold just 33,000 Model 6300s in 1984. IBM, on the other hand, sold 880,000 PCs that year. Even Apple sold 275,000 Macintoshes. How sad is that? Even Apple did better. AT&T doesn't break out individual profit and loss figures in its official annual report, but contemporary media estimated that their computer and telephone equipment arm, ATTIS, lost about $750 million in 1983. In 1984, the company's full-year profit of about $1.4 billion was down substantially from expectations due to product sales not being what they were. AT&T blamed this underperformance on several things. A worldwide shortage of silicon in 1984 that hurt sales of larger systems. And there remained some residual regulatory limits that prevented AT&T from bundling telephone and computer products together, leading to a contradictory but rather amusing situation where the AT&T Model 6300 computer cannot be sold in AT&T's own phone stores. So there was all that. But don't worry, top management expected things to be better in 1985, with AT&T saying that they will open up sales of its own chip to other vendors. And the aforementioned Charles Marshall said that their core industry focus was small business and not the home market. So, no worries. Even so, people still wanted to know, where was the real AT&T PC, the one that would run Unix? This finally arrived in March 1985 with the AT&T Unix PC. Also called the Model 7300, the PC was built in conjunction with Convergent and priced at about $5,590. It had 512K of RAM, one floppy disk drive, and a 10-megabyte hard drive. The hardware has this slanted, distinct design that has shown up in a few movies and TV shows in the late 1980s. To smooth away Unix's unfriendliness, AT&T layered a GUI on top of it. Users can navigate menus and activate applications by clicking on them. Applications live inside windows that you can resize, move around, and overlap with one another. There is also multitasking. Reviewers noted that the Unix GUI, designed by a Princeton professor named Carol Ferkner, was not quite as polished as, say, the Macintosh's. It leans more on text than icons, which is what the Macintosh did. There were also some nagging issues. The mouse pointer's accuracy was questionable, and the menu button placements lacked polish, like a shutdown command placed perilously close to the run button. That is just evil. However, reviewers universally said that the hardware was fine. The biggest problem were the applications. The Unix PC's best software applications were, surprise, for communications. You plugged your telephone into the computer, and then the computer to the wall jack. Then you can use the Unix PC software to automatically dial someone with a computerized address book. It can record your calls and let you add little notes to those recordings. And it even has a timer so you can manage your long-distance bill. Wow, forgot that existed. Beyond that, however, the application ecosystem was nothing like that of MS-DOS or even Apple. AT&T bundled three applications for reviewers: a business graphics package, a word processor, and a spreadsheet application called SuperComp 20, or now 2020. SuperComp 20 worked, but not well. It doesn't work with the mouse and can't handle a spreadsheet with 4,000 cells, and calculating a 3,000-cell sheet took up to 11 minutes. Lotus 1-2-3 on an IBM PC, on the other hand, took just seconds. And the word processor was competent. It was modeled on Wang's Wang writer, saying that phrase was the only reason I added this section here, but ran slow. It can't display more than 17 lines of 64 characters, which feels limiting. We can blame some of these problems on not having enough memory. Unix is said to be quite memory hungry. But even if they added this expensive memory, the main issue is that Unix was a ghost town, applications-wise. I said before, in 1985, MS-DOS had 5 times more applications than Unix did. For its Unix PC, AT&T said that it would have 28 applications at launch with, quote, several more in the 90 days after. A few big names did agree to bring something to the market. Microsoft said it would, quote-unquote, port its word processor, Word, though that turned out to be a version developed for their own Unix variant, Xenix, and then translated to the Unix PC using an interpretation layer, so not a native experience. Ashton Tate, the famous software company, said it would port over its popular database management software, DBase, so in essence, dropping DBase. But as for the third of the big three software companies in the 1980s, Lotus, maker of the killer spreadsheet app Lotus 1-2-3, well, they still held out. The Unix PC can technically run all Unix-based software, but reviewers noted that there were very few Unix applications for small businesses, even compared to CPM, Tandy's TR-DOS, and even Apple's ProDOS. Whatever happened to the partnership with the famous Digital Research Inc.? The deal was dissolved before the Unix PC's release without much explanation and any output. People in the Unix community thought the whole thing was vaporware from the very beginning. The AT&T Unix PC was literally made by a committee of marketers, scientists, and service personnel. The hardware boasted nothing exciting enough to get people to switch over. And as for Unix, systems managers had long known of Unix but saw no reason to abandon the years of training and software they had built up for IBM-associated operating systems to switch over to it. Portability across machines and ideals like being quote-unquote open were for them not worth it. Unit sales of the AT&T Unix PC quickly slumped after its release. The only initial big buyers were the Bell operating companies, AT&T's former subsidiaries, and those sales quickly petered out. In 1985, it was estimated that AT&T sold 12,000 to 18,000 Unix PCs. IBM sold 1 million IBM PCs. Apple sold 420,000 Macs. Even the AT&T Model 6300, that mid-IBM compatible, moved 3 times more units with 70,000. So, AT&T's next microcomputer was not another Unix PC, but the IBM-compatible 6300 Plus, released in October 1985. That was just an Olivetti M24, powered by the Intel 286, with some new software allowing it to run both MS-DOS and Unix applications side-by-side, which was cool, but still not enough. In mid-1986, Convergent Technologies, the OEM, reported order cuts of Unix PCs by AT&T due to poor sales. They received permission to try to sell the computer on their own, which they did, calling it the S50. By late 1986, it was clear to outside observers that AT&T had lost the conviction and determination it once had for the industry, especially microcomputers. They took just 6% of the market that year, almost all of it with IBM-compatible 6300s. The microcomputer division was estimated to have lost an eye-popping $600 million on $250 to $300 million of sales. Punishing layoffs were announced that year. Thomas Crotty of Gartner Security said that AT&T was already out by then, just maintaining their internal stuff. Quote, "They have $2 billion worth of their own systems in-house and will be spending time keeping those operations going." In October 1986, AT&T turned over their PC business to Olivetti and halted shipments of the Unix PC altogether. The reality was that the company had far bigger fish to fry back home in its core long-distance business, which continued to face punishing intense competition from MCI and Sprint. In 1988, AT&T turned its first financial loss in 104 years, losing $1.67 billion. AT&T President Robert Allen said that in entering computers, quote, "Our appetite was too broad. We learned a lot since then. Our significant strength is in networking, and we have a better sense of where we can play." Their failure in making and selling PC hardware would lead them to strike a deal with Sun, sparking the second phase of what we call the Unix Wars. On one positive note, they kept making their own mini computers for a few more years. In 1988, they introduced the Super Mini 3B4000, known for its modular architecture. Cool little thing. I'm glad they kept doing it. Looking back, there are a few interesting what-ifs. What if the PC used the WE32000? You know, AT&T's own chip, the one it made itself for its well-regarded 3B line. For reasons we may never know, AT&T's bureaucracy prevented the company from releasing the chip specs to Convergent. So Convergent built the Unix PC with a Motorola 6810 CPU, a momentous decision that cannot be reversed. Maybe the outcome would have been the same, but users of the 3B minicomputer line all said that thing screamed. Imagine all that power in a PC. What if they used their money to buy a distribution channel, maybe the computer retailer Radio Shack, to get direct access to the consumer? But I feel like such a move would have probably alarmed their sales and retail partners. What if they truly open-sourced the Unix code, like how Google open-sourced Android? AT&T did license the OS to Hewlett-Packard, DEC, Fujitsu, and NEC, but licensees could not call it Unix, and they often modified it into something weird. I wonder if truly open-sourcing the code would have driven wider adoption, attracted more application developers, and truly leveraged Unix's portability. And what if AT&T ran the Compaq playbook? Though it didn't work out for them in the end, Compaq was then in the midst of prying IBM's PC ecosystem away from it. The Model 6300 was a competent computer. What if they just followed along in Compaq's footsteps? Guess we will never know. All in all, AT&T seriously did the PC business for about a year, maybe 2 to 3 at the most. Talk about being in, right? In the end, the thing that most strikes me about AT&T's foray into computers was its arrogance, a smugness that is hard to like. As I got started in 1984, AT&T ran an ad called The Computer Game. In it, a person moves a small AT&T Model 6300 board game piece alongside other computers, and then moves it over a small bridge from MS-DOS into Unix. The man moving the piece then sits down with a smug smile and says, "Your move." What kind of ad is that? AT&T talked up their machine's technical quality and their ability to sell it to Fortune 2000 companies and small businesses with their 6,000 plus strong sales force and bevy of corporate alliances, against IBM of all things. In 1985, when introducing the 6300 Plus, James Edwards, AT&T Information Systems' president, said, "We have out-PCAT'd IBM right now." Quotes like these, and I mentioned a few more earlier in this video, just never look good. In the end, they couldn't see what was in front of them. AT&T has a reputation only a mother can love. Whoever has had a good interaction with their telephone provider? Now imagine them providing your computer. American corporate history is littered with the corpses of big businesses that tried to quote-unquote do computer. AT&T, creator of the transistor, creator of Unix, seemed like it had a better chance than, say, Exxon. But they still failed, all the same. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.